Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
There's a certain way in which what I'm writing about is the kind of hiding I did from my own self, from my own intuition, from my own feelings about others, from my own feelings about this event, and the ways in which there's a kind of colonizing of the self by any world any of us live in, right? We're all in some sense subject to the time and place in which we live. And that allows us to understand certain aspects of our experience more clearly than at any other time. And it obscures other aspects more fully than other time periods and places.
I'm Jordan Kistner, and you're listening to Thresholds, a series of free-ranging conversations with writers and artists about moments of epiphany or transformation that changed their lives and their work. A moment that they stepped across, like a threshold, into something new, and the way that experience changed everything they made afterward. I first encountered the writing of Megan O'Rourke many years ago when The New Yorker published an excerpt of her memoir, The Long Goodbye, which is about her relationship with her mother and her mother's death from cancer. It was the kind of piece that just stops you in your tracks. In my case, I was sitting on the one train in New York and I missed my stop. And it was one of those reading experiences that I still remember so clearly. The prose was so full of love, but it wasn't soft or saccharine at all. It was written with such vividness and precision that I felt like her mother became someone that I knew. I sent it to my own mom. This combination of poetry and acuity is a hallmark of Megan's writing. She is a poet, to start with. She's written 3 collections of poetry. And in her prose, she retains that feel for language while drawing also on deep critical and reportorial skills. Her second book of nonfiction, The Invisible Kingdom, was one of the 2022 finalists for the National Book Award. It's sort of a titanic work, which tells the story of her own battles with mysterious and chronic illness, while also analyzing the history of how our healthcare system comes up short when it's trying to understand and treat chronic illness of all kinds. It's so hard to write about being sick, particularly with a mysterious and perhaps chronic disease, which rarely offers the triumphant, happy endings we're trained to want from our illness narratives. But Megan manages to make the book, like all the rest of her work, vivid and urgent, poetic and sharp. We met last year when she reached out to me in her capacity as the editor of the Yale Review to write a short essay for her, which I only mentioned because it comes up in our chat. I was excited to get to have a long, non-editorial conversation with her, and we wound up talking about the new book she's working on, which is about her sons, the death of her father, and an experience she had of sexual assault when she was younger. We don't get into detail about that experience, but if you're wanting to avoid the subject altogether, this may not be the episode for you. Mostly, we talked about the challenges and thrills of working on a book without knowing how it all comes together, and about the way that people often hide from themselves the parts of their own stories that feel too hard to look at, and what it feels like to her to be putting an end to some of that hiding in her own story. As always, you can find us online, send us an email, or check out the e-publication arm of Thresholds at thisisthresholds.com. Here's Megan O'Rourke.
You know, it's interesting. I have about like 30,000 words of something, which so far has been this very braided manuscript of prose that tells in some ways the story of having very young children and sort of, in fact, there's a whole scene of the labor of my second child and also braids into it. And I should say that both of my children are sons, and also braids into it the death of my father. But the real core or the real kind of threshold, I think, of the book that I'm trying to cross that I won't be able to articulate adequately here, and maybe that will be useful to your listeners, is something about an experience, and I will give a trigger warning here, but something about an experience, a firsthand experience I had of sexual violence and sexual trauma when I was 21, at the hands of, you know, someone who had, in fact, been a boyfriend, in fact, had been someone I loved very much and who no longer was. And it's something I think in some ways I've been writing around for a long time without writing directly into. I think I had no way to write directly into it. And, you know, until recently, I was kind of looking at this mash of words and saying, well, it's so strange. Why are all these threads here together? The children, my father, and this incident with K, as I call him in the book. And then, of course, the answer is almost all too obvious. But it was a very interesting, it has been a very interesting process of writing something that's kind of writing itself. And at some point is asking me to make sense of it. And then, you know, in a way, the threads here can be kind of all too easily pulled out and pulled together, right? But in a way that I had to kind of trick myself into not understanding what I was writing in order to write what I've written so far. I don't know if this makes any sense.
Or if
you've ever had an experience of like writing something that you're very compelled to write without fully understanding it.
That's most of my writing experiences. Yeah. is thinking, I know these things all belong in the same document, but I couldn't tell you why. And then there's a point at which I can begin to articulate why all those things are there in the same place.
Exactly. And then you have to do the work of articulating it, but leaving the mystery too, right? Like that some of that friction of mystery needs to remain. If it becomes too legible, then it tips into some other kind of writing, I think. Yeah.
Are you comfortable in that space where you're writing and you know that you're writing because you're compelled by some reason that there is a connection and yet it's not evident to you yet? Is that a comfortable, exciting space for you as a writer?
I love this question. I think it is not comfortable, but also exciting. I think that I experience writing as like a kind of compulsion. There's a compulsion involved in trying to do it, and there is a certain intuitive feeling my way forward. And I think I am in some sense comfortable because my work as a poet, which I haven't talked about yet so far explicitly, writing poems very much is that for me. It's just that usually I'm writing lyric poems. They're relatively short. So it does feel different to be engaged in a state of real unknowing with a much larger expanse. And it feels exciting because my last book, The Invisible Kingdom, was one that I really had to map out. There was an outline. I've never used an outline in my life. There were file cards with the chapter titles. The book ended up looking like the outline, which was astonishing to me. And so I think I am having a lot of fun letting a kind of more subconscious part come forward, a different relationship to the psyche, to delusion, to hopefulness, you know, just let all these other intangible, associative, silly, suppressed elements come out.
Yeah. And just if you'll indulge, like maybe a technical question, how do you have a kind of process structure that allows for that kind of associative, maybe more subconscious writing process to unfold? Is this made possible or made easier because you're writing? Maybe the better way of asking this question is, how do you organize yourself? How do you organize your writing while you're writing in that more subconscious, associative place?
Oh God, it's such a mess. It's really organized. Organized is probably not the word here to use, but I know exactly what you mean. There's two ways I've been proceeding with this particular project. I've been thinking a lot about John Ashbery's book, Flowchart, which he wrote, which is a book-length poem. And I don't know, you know, if how many of your listeners will know John Ashbery's work, but, you know, a late 20th century, early 21st century American poet kind of inheritor of the French surrealists, part of the New York school, very interested in the way that the lyric poem could access the full register of American idioms, from the pedantic to the goofy. You know, so there's like poems about Daffy Duck in Hollywood, but there's also poems about, you know, an Angra painting. I don't know if I'm saying his name correctly. And in Flowchart, I think it was written after his mother died, and he told himself he would write a little bit every day until the anniversary of her death, if I'm getting that right. It was something like that, where he had a very conceptual framework. And so with this, I had young kids, it was the pandemic, I was not really getting any writing done. And I told myself, well, I'll write 500 to 1,000 words, you know, every day, as much as I can. And I won't worry about how they match up. It will kind of be like in a game of Exquisite Corpse, but with my own work. I'll just take up where the day brings me. And that's basically how I've written most of this. And I think I've ended up writing like really, really quite a lot of words. I will say now that I have a lot of words, I am in the position of having to try to organize it. And it's very disorganized. And I think what I have to do is, in a sense, sort of switch from being a writer into being an editor and read this almost as an editor might, and look for those, or as a detective might, and to look for the threads that are connecting, to look for the, in particular with this manuscript, to look for the places I have been hiding from myself, and hiding from things I want to say. There's a lot of hiding in this book, I think.
Tell me more about that. What does hiding look like in your manuscript?
Well, I think this entire book is about hiding, because in a way what the book is about, as I said, you know, again, using the trigger warning, there's this sort of act of sexual violence that precipitates it, that then other acts, sort of thinking about other acts of sexual violence or encounters of coercion, let's say, come up. And I think it took me until very recently to realize that what I'm writing about are ideas of acquiescence and refusal, and in particular acquiescence in the way in which to be you know, a woman of my age, you know, in my 40s, Gen X, kind of acculturated in a very specific patriarchal milieu. The part of what the book is trying to do is to really animate what the word patriarchy means, right? What actually happens to the individual imagination, and really the imagination, as it, you know, comes to being in a world with a very specific set of norms that it is expected to fit itself into, that do not necessarily, you know, prioritize your own well-being mentally, physically, otherwise. And so, but that comes with a lot of complexity, because you're coming into being in a world you love, full of people you love who are flawed people. And so I think, I don't know if this makes any sense, there's a certain way in which what I'm writing about is the kind of hiding I did from my own self, from my own intuition, from my own feelings about others, from my own feelings about this event, and the ways in which there's a kind of colonizing of the self by any world any of us live in, right? We're all in some sense subject to the time and place in which we live. And that allows us to understand certain aspects of our experience more clearly than at any other time. And it obscures other aspects more fully than other time periods and places, right? Does this, I hope, kind of make some sense?
Yeah, yeah.
And that's part of that. So part of what I'm trying to trace is that, and again, not in an argument-driven way, but really almost in a kind of novelistic way, I think, a little bit, what it means to acquiesce, and then what it means to realize that your acquiescence was not actually a kind of full-throated, right? What are the ways in which acquiescence is coerced, and what are the ways in which it's genuine?
Right. One can acquiesce, but not quite freely.
Right, and maybe sometimes that's okay. And I'm not talking about sexual trauma here. I'm talking about other kinds of acquiescence, right? Like, what is, you know, we acquiesce to all kinds of things that aren't like our, you know, to thine own self be true, right? We live among others, right? So to live in any society, we acquiesce to all kinds. You know, right now, we're all acquiescing to climate change that we wish we weren't, right? There are more benign versions of this, like my, you know, grandmother might serve me a meal that I don't really feel like eating. It's not that tasty, but I acquiesce to eating it to be polite. Right? That's the banal version. So
right.
I'm kind of interested in that whole spectrum.
Is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I'm always curious about the subject that we avoid for a long time because it's not quite right. Or it's not maybe not the right time, or we're not ready, or you know, any of the various reasons you might spend a decade or two avoiding a subject that you've been circling. Yeah. How did you know that it was finally time to write about this experience you had when you were 19?
I mean, Jordan, I really don't even know. You know, I feel like I might take this entire manuscript and just like hide it away. Right? It's just rather terrifying. I was just saying to somebody last night, it's the because my work to date has sometimes had very personal elements in it. You know, losing my mother, going through a divorce, being very sick, showing myself to be vulnerable. I'm often asked, you know, it must be so hard to share these things about yourself. And perhaps because of a deficiency in my soul, it really hasn't been hard.
or maybe just your vulnerability is actually elsewhere and other people would find that vulnerable, but that's not where yours is.
Yes, 1,000%. Yes, I think that's the true. And I also think that in the cases of this writing, I have come to feel very confident in the need to dramatize that vulnerability where it did exist on the page, that there was a need that went beyond my own, that there was a need that others might have in encountering these stories that I could really kind of believe in. This project feels like I have my hands on it less than I had my hands on that material. You know, it's harder. And I think that must be why now, to answer your question, right? As we grow as writers, as we do more, it's not that things get easier, but you've tackled a certain kind of technical problem or formal problem or a certain kind of material, and you've managed to wrestle it into something. And this, I think on a sort of on a technical level, there's some part of me that's like, I don't know how to do this. So that's interesting. Then I think to time, you know, I think kind of just time itself is the subject of this book. And the other thing I'll share more concretely is that this person who I am writing about and remembering, who is a beloved person in my life, actually died in the pandemic. And so,
oh gosh.
Yeah. And so not of the pandemic, something totally unrelated. But one of the things that happens to you as a writer when a person in your life dies is that you experience it as the end of a kind of story. And I realized that there was a story I was telling myself in which we would have an encounter in which I would understand more of the story. He would tell me something, or the encounter itself would leave more legible, something that has always been mysterious to me about, you know, kind of what happened and how someone who had loved me could harm me, right? Which is sort of the enduring mystery that many of us have experienced in our lives, right? And,
right.
And it's actually shockingly common, right? To have experienced profound harm at the hands of someone who actually did love us in their own way. Well, that's, I guess, a question. So the end of that possibility of that story, I think, also precipitated a kind of crisis, so a kind of narrative crisis that I then needed to write into, right? Like, what is this? What happens when you can't ever, and you probably never could, but now you really can't ever reconcile something and find out the answer, right? There's
how
no
did
answer.
How did you hear that he had died?
So it was incredibly shocking and very pandemic moment, which was that I was teaching online and embarrassed to say that we were approaching our break and I had multiple screens open on my computer, which I should not have had. And but I hadn't closed out something and I got a DM notification with like a little ping. And a friend of ours, whom I had not also been in touch with in, 20 years, just texted and said, I just wanted to let you know that Kay died a few days ago. And so I was in sort of mid-sentence, holding forth and just said, okay, you know what, we are going to take a break. And that was how I got the news, was sort of sitting in my, in my teaching clothes. I think I did have regular pants on, not pajamas, uh-huh. Teaching, but at home, my children were home. It was like the full pandemic, like no one was out. The 18-month-old was home, the 3-year-old was home, I was home trying to teach, and this kind of news came in. So it all felt very mediated and strange. And there was something about that too, that, I think that was a time where we were thinking about time a lot, where we were thinking about mediation, where everything seemed and still seems so strangely unreal and all too real, right? And so all of that kind of came together to just feel like whatever the feeling is that pushes me into writing a poem but I just started making these prose notes. And I was already writing about my father and my sons, and somehow this became part of it. Yeah.
Do you feel like, so you're writing about your father, you're writing about sons, you're writing about Kay. I mean, to what extent does this feel like you engaging with the problem of masculinity? I don't really mean it that way, but with masculinity and its sort of attendant, what it means to love men and also have been hurt by men and also to have produced men, to have created male creatures.
Well, I think this is the great mystery of one of the great mysteries of my life. And it sounds very banal, but, it turns out to be true that these very, and I think, you and I, many of us who were adults at the time lived through the Me Too movement, which was a really profound reckoning, right? There were many deeply profound things about that moment for me. I think I was pregnant with my second son, that my dad died during it or after it, and then my son was born, and then the pandemic happened. And there's this way in which some of the reckoning that Me Too precipitated, although the discourse has kind of taken a backseat, I think for me has only come more and more to the forefront. And I suspect this might be true for many people. In fact, I'd be curious to talk to more people and find out if this is true, that in a way it cracked open things that the very public discourse could only do certain things with. And then we all are having a kind of ongoing private reckoning, perhaps. Certainly I am. And
yeah. Can I just push on that for a second? I would love to know a little bit more about what you mean. Like when you say that, it evokes what sort of my thinking and feeling has been since then, but I don't want to assume that that's been the same as yours. So what do you mean about this kind of like the long tail of private and personal thinking and reckoning?
I think at the time, like many of us, not all of us, but I did post things on social media that alluded to some of these events. I, in fact, wrote a very short piece for an editor I think we both share at the New York Times Magazine, Sasha Weiss. Mm-hmm. Very short piece about Me Too. I was part of various public discussions. and experience that public reckoning and the hashtag as I think as a moment in which for the first time ever, I to another person used the word rape to describe this experience that I had had in my 20s with Kay, a word I had probably never allowed myself to use. And because that was so new, and because I'm a writer, which is to say that in order to understand many of the things that preoccupy me and that I think preoccupy our society, there's a kind of private work I have to do before I can really talk about it in public. It was almost like the order of thinking was reversed, right? That I was kind of thinking aloud in public, like events overtook me. And then, does this make any sense? And then afterward, it kind of cracked things open that I had not really articulated to myself or allowed myself to feel. And the only way to do that was to start writing. And that's where I think writing about masculinity, writing about men in my life, I think also my mother died in 2008. My son was born, you know, 10 years after she died. And my last child, I knew it was my last child. He was the fortuitous accident, you know. And so I really knew, okay, I have this like complete new generation in my life and it's all men. You know, I have no sisters. My mother's not alive and my father died. And my father obviously was like, as in my case, was a very key figure in my life, a very beloved figure, but also tied up in all of this in complicated ways. So I think that's the long tail for me is both a kind of writerly problem, which is probably a reason I write is that to understand anything, I have to write about it. And then also this kind of interesting biographical reality. And I think for me, a lot of nonfiction comes out of a biographical reality that somehow also is an aesthetic or literary problem for me. Does this make sense? So it's I'm not always interested in just writing about biography. It's where biography kind of maps onto in The Invisible Kingdom. It was like, well, how do we tell a story about an illness that doesn't go away? We don't tell that story. So how could I tell it formally? Mm-hmm. And I think in this case, it's like, how do I tell a private story publicly in terms that are mine?
Right. Because in a sense, in that initial gesture, which was so interesting about the first few days and weeks of Me Too, like you told that story publicly in a sense, but yes, using language that was not maybe your language or was newly your language.
Yes.
And now it's like having a net, which I think you're right that a lot of people had that same experience of saying, oh, me too. And then as the words were leaving their mouth, realizing, wait a minute, hang right on a second. I've said that out loud and I have to think maybe in a different way about what that means for me, not to have just experienced it, but also spoken it public, like turned it into a speech act.
Absolutely. And I think that act of identification and of being an individual caught up in a larger social discourse was really important for me. It was one of the first times I've really experienced how being subsumed in others' voices can have a genuinely unlocking effect rather than a kind of performative add-on. Does this make sense? Like, sometimes one joins discourses to be part of the thing or to belong. In this case, it was really different. It really unlocked something. It really helped me see and understand and feel the strength to kind of address something. At the same time, there's a kind of, and also I, right? And now what does that also mean for the I of my story? And I think lots of people have that, right? Because everyone's story is different too. And that's really important, those differences.
Yeah, particularly in and among a chorus, right? I think sometimes, even as you're struggling to figure out what your story was that you were adding in, but when you are joining a chorus, you're also trying to think alongside other people and think like, okay, well, how bad was that? And how do I understand what that means for my past and means for my future? Yeah. And, you know.
Well, and here's the other interesting thing. I mean, to me, interesting. That moment changed the world, but it didn't rebuild the world, right? It didn't totally revolutionize the world, right? That we live in. And like many things that are being torn down and rebuilt, it's a partial rebuilding. So there's this really interesting way in which there are these moments of extremity in which one kind of gives oneself over to that revolutionary act. And then you have to go on in a world that remains the muddled world, the murky world, the world that you're refusing, right? And so I'm very interested in that too. I am, you know, I just read this interesting book about crossword puzzles and anorexia by Anna Schechtman that's coming out later this spring. And she has this really insightful moment in the book, probably my favorite, where she talks about one of the challenges of recovering from anorexia is that you can never refuse. I mean, you can, but you would die, which was not, in fact, her goal. The act of committing to a kind of disordered logic always had this kind of, you know, extra disorder in it because you're partaking of the thing you're refusing, right? You can't give up food entirely as an anorexic. You have to control it. And I think there's something about that feels parallel to what I'm figuring out, which is like, how do you inhabit a world that feels very flawed in many ways, not just gender relations or sexual violence, but climate and politics and all of this. But how do you inhabit it in this flawed way, you know, with some commitment to certain forms of refusal? Where is it appropriate to acquiesce? Where not? I'm making it sound very abstract, but I think these are really freighted, real questions that we live with day to day in a kind of urgent way.
Yeah, I mean, certainly. And I think everybody feels that the urgency of that problem maybe in different areas, depending on their different life experience. But yeah, I feel like I don't know any thinking people who are paying attention in the world and aren't thinking about, okay, how much can I refuse the things that are horrible about the world in which I nevertheless continue to live?
Right. And because, you know, the ultimate refusal, I think, leads to depression and alienation too, right? I mean, refusal is a two-pronged sword. It can be enlivened. I mean, I guess that's the dilemma. Like, there's one side of the coin that leads to depression and alienation. The other side of the coin, you know, leads to the glorious revolution, right? And how do we? Yeah, I don't know. These are real questions, and they're going to be only get more real for the next generation.
Yeah, the problem of acquiescence is I'm so interested in that word that you've chosen or that chose you in this project because it has such a double edge on it, right? Mm-hmm. Like you have to acquiesce, and it is good to acquiesce sometimes. And yet the gesture of acquiescence is a morally complicated one, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
When you're thinking about these things to write about them, K dies and Me Too is happening. And to what extent is it a problem that you're experiencing as like a feelings problem versus a thinking problem? Like, does this come up for you as an intellectual problem or a problem that you're attacking intellectually through writing? Or is it more emotional than that? Not that they're mutually exclusive.
Well, I think that so far, maybe this is another way of describing the difference between writing this book and The Invisible Kingdom, is with The Invisible Kingdom, I really had to get the intellectual piece clear to myself in order to write the book, or the book draft would have been, you know, 2,000 pages. And with this, It's much more feelings. And in fact, most of the writing I've done has been set in this very narrow window between 1995 and 1997 in terms of the K thread. Then there's a present day thread that's kind of my children. And I don't know how much of that will stay in the book. Some of that writing might end up feeling like it needs to be private for their sake, for my sake, maybe because all so much writing about children can feel precious. But it's been important to kind of stage in the text these two different timelines. But a lot of the writing has been just almost time to time travel to what it was like to be, you know, first in college and then, you know, 21 in New York City in this very specific milieu, this highly, you know, kind of developed in certain ways idea of who I thought I was. And to be able to look at that person now who really is not me. And there's an amazing moment, you know, the book is very influenced by, I hate to say it, by Annie Ernaux, and, you know, started long before she won the Nobel Prize. But there's an incredible moment in one of her memoirs where she's also talking about a kind of negative, and in her case, a negative sexual experience, that she looks at the girl she was and she switches to describing her in the third person. And before I ever read her book, I had done the same thing because it just felt very intuitive to, you know, speaking of feelings versus intellectualizing it, just like it just happened. Just the pronoun shift happened without me noticing because I don't feel like that person. So I am proceeding very much by feelings. And I think that one of the things, you know, writing is a little bit like running. I used to be a serious runner, and running never gets easier as you do it, but you do get more used to just putting on your shoes and going out the door. And I think that has been the case with this, that it's just, I used to feel this pressure to make the work good. And I really, probably for worse, but I don't feel it in quite the same way anymore. I feel more of a sense that I have to follow the things that I'm resisting and that's my job. I need to just follow my own resistance and get to the thing that's hiding, as I was saying earlier. But, you know, it's a kind of hiding that finds it. There's a joy in finding, as Winnicott.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, you know, it's a disaster not to be found. So I think it would probably be a disaster for these things not to be found. And so I'm kind of enjoying that. I don't know, that thread, following that thread.
Yeah, I am excited to feel like I get to ask you this next question, kind of mid. Stream.
Yeah.
Because I feel like I normally get to ask it at the end of projects. But yeah. How has the writing you've done so far, has it shifted how you understand what happened to you when you were 19 or how you think about it? I'm presuming probably so, but I'm curious to hear.
Yeah, it has shifted it profoundly. And I think one of the things, and maybe this is why hiding is coming up so much, and I can kind of concretize the hiding. I think one of the things that's so clear, that was really not clear to me, is how much I hid from myself. How terrible this experience was, right? That my own way of dealing with it was to kind of hide the experience from me, the narrator of my idea of a continuous selfhood. And, you know, to the point where I thought, okay, this was the only time that there was some kind of moment of, you know, violence between us or coercion. And then as I've been writing the book, I go back and I identified all these memories come back where I'm like, well, right, then there was this. And so I think that's been a profound reminder that, you know, the self is a kind of social discipline that we impose on our own being. And that social discipline gets shaped by the practices around us. And that even those of us who are writers and think, you know, we're truth tellers, I think of myself as writing about things that people don't want to talk about, that they tell false stories about. The ultimate teller of false stories turns out to be me, you know. And I think maybe that's the thing I've discovered is like, oh, right. Of course, we all know we tell ourselves false stories. But to kind of realize that's the real subject. It's not so much K. It's me that's the subject in the end. Just, yeah.
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 Is that a Is that distressing or does it have a little bit of delight in it?
Probably both, right? I think I don't know if it's delight, but I think that one of the things I really enjoy about getting older, one of the reasons I'm very glad to have lived this long and hope that I will live much longer, in fact, is because your sense of narrative really changes in ways that I find so extremely exciting as a writer and thinker. And actually, to me, makes the world feel really new, like a new place to be described, new place to build friendships, because just the way I think is genuinely changing. And so I think that's the, if there's a delight or there's like a wellspring in that, right? And I think also the other thing is as I said, this is kind of a story of discovering my own self-deception, but I think again that this is a very, very universal in different ways. Many of us can relate to that experience of kind of lying to ourselves about something. And I think there's comfort in realizing that none of us escape free in that sense. Like we're all in this, that part of it together. So how do we get through it? Well, we get through it by speaking, right? And by talking about this process of kind of peeling the onion back, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Is there a...
Can I say one other thing?
Oh, also, please. Yeah, yeah.
Just on a very local level. The other delight, by the way, is just like revisiting 1996 and all of its bizarreness. And then realizing, for example, my research took me recently to realize that like teenagers today think of Nirvana as preppy, which I discovered from this Slate piece. Yes, apparently so. And then having like really been like in my little time machine of my brain going back to 1996, like, and even earlier than 96, like, you know, listening to, you know, Smells Like Teen Spirit for the first time and what that felt like and how revolutionary. And yeah, so it's just been this, it's really interesting to kind of be able to use writing as a form of time travel.
Oh my gosh. I mean, did you make yourself a syllabus or something to go like, what is that diving back in?
Nicole, it's Nicole Holofcener, right? Who wrote Made Walking and Talking. Is that her?
Mm-hmm. I think so.
Walking, you know, like rereading Thomas Pynchon, like David Foster Wallace, trying to remember things like AOL dial-up. I've been on a walking tour of many of the spaces that I was in a lot, trying to remember New York before it became, I don't know, sort of glassed over with a certain wealth that it now has. You know, remembering showing up at parties in Soho and like, you know, those buildings were not fancy yet. They were beautiful, but there were, you know, like old construction elevators. Anyway, just really trying to, yes. So if people have syllabus suggestions, I would love to hear them. But I'm trying to go back to, you know, the music, the films, film in particular, independent film in particular, because that was a really big part of my life at the time. And somehow it all feels like an independent film and that feeling of like walking into a video store and not having access, curating, I suppose, one's experience more.
Do you have a next horizon line on this project, either formally or creatively, intellectually, that you're sort of trying to hit? Like, is there a door you're trying to get yourself through with this project?
I think I'm trying to see in the next 6 months whether it really is something I would share with other people, you know, whether it really is. Whether it works as writing, you know, and in if it does, in what form is it book length? Is it an essay? Is it an essay among other essays? I don't fully know the answers to those questions yet. And it's the first time that I've felt very patient in my writing about coming. Usually I feel incredibly impatient to solve the problems and figure things out. And I just haven't this time. So I am trying to set myself that the threshold of the spring feels like the time by which I should know, you know, is this something that just goes back in the drawer for a few years, you know, while I continue to think, is it really taken on a life of its own? Is it becoming something that would be read by others?
Well, I hope selfishly that it's something that you decide can be read by others, but I also love the idea that it might just might serve another function for you.
Yeah. You know, right. You never know. And, you know, thinking back to your question about thresholds, I think the other thing I've been thinking a lot about is about learning, you know, and that for whatever reason, as a writer right now, I also feel just like I have to drink in a lot of other people's writing and books I just never read, ideas, kind of concepts I never came to. So there's this way in which I do feel at a threshold in which I'm kind of drinking in the world again. And maybe this also has to do with exiting the part of parenting that is parenting very young children, in which your life really narrows in certain ways. Even as I do believe that emotionally it can expand if you allow it to. So there's this, I don't know, threshold has felt like a very generative word to be given at this time.
Well, good. I'm glad. I feel like there's no, that's one of the things that I have been surprised by and pleased by with it, is that it can kind of meet any mood and any part of the process when it comes to writing or making things.
Well, I wonder if you also feel that, I mean, something I find myself saying to students of writing a lot is that sometimes they're trying to write an essay where they know too much. They know what's on the other side of that threshold. And I wonder if, in a sense, this is a really generative word, because it conveys that sense that there is somewhere to arrive, right? But the whole point of crossing certainly a new threshold is that we don't know what's on the other side. We may know, but we don't know what it feels like to stand in that space. And I don't know, I'm curious about your own writing and whether you also feel like there has to be something figured out in the process of writing.
I don't think that I very frequently have an experience. Even if I'm writing an essay where I kind of think I know what it's going to be about and where it's going, when I don't stumble across, when there isn't something that I have discovered about, usually about what I think, often about the, if it's reported, it's about, you know, there are a lot of things that I'm discovering that I had no idea about. But even if I'm sitting down for like relatively speaking, the driest, sort of most reported out. Or even like I sat down yesterday to write a book review. And that's not it's not terribly complicated, but I sat down and really thought, I have no idea what I'm going to say about this book. dislike it, but I actually am not sure that I have useful thoughts about this. And then I sat down and 2,000 words later, I was like, oh, I did have some thoughts about that. And so, and that's like a very prosaic experience of that. But even in that, even on that kind of day where I'm not doing like spiritually enlightening, I'm not plumbing the depths or anything. I'm just writing book review. But almost all of the writing that I'm doing for fun or because I feel like there's something I want to get out is discovery based. It's like there's something that I want to say, or there's something that needs to be articulated, or there's a connection I want to draw, but I don't know what it is. I mean, which I feel like is exciting and sometimes frustrating to me. Like when we worked on that short piece that I did for you, I mean, one of the things that was like felt to me like an example of the way you can back yourself into a corner doing that, where I was thinking, like, I was like, well, I don't know that I have anything to say, but I'll try. And then I almost had like, I have like a half something to say. And then it took me a while to figure out and your help to figure out where I was going with that. You know, like there's a risk when you write in that way that like actually nothing really helpful is going to come out the other side of it.
Yeah. No, and that you've articulated exactly what it is that this writing project feels high risk to me, because I'm less sure than ever that there's something coming out on the other side. But I have some kind of feeling that it's important to put yourself in that. You said back into a corner, but maybe it's put yourself on an open space, you know, where you don't know what you can build. And there's something, I don't know, I feel like it's gotta be good, right? It's gotta be good for us.
Thresholds is produced by Jordan Kistner and Drew Broussard. Music and editing by Laura Faye Oshavood of Arthur Moon. Our art is by Lorelei Grossman. Sign up for our newsletter, listen to past episodes, and get in touch at our website, thisisthresholds.com. Don't forget to rate and review our show at Apple Podcasts. It really helps. Thanks. We'll see you soon.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.